Osteoporosis, a disease that causes bones to become thin, weak, and to break easily, is a major public health threat for 44 million Americans, 68% of which are women. In the United States today, 10 million individuals already have osteoporosis, and 34 million more have low bone mass, placing them at increased risk for this disease. One out of every two women and one in four men over 50 will have an osteoporosis-related fracture in his or her lifetime. So what can be done about this silent disease, and what do we need to know to prevent it and to treat it? Joining us this morning to help us find the answers are Dr. Jennifer Kelly, an assistant professor of medicine specializing in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolic disorders at the Upstate Medical University and Upstate's Joslin Diabetes Center, and Dr. Karen Kemis, a physical therapist and exercise physiologist with the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Upstate Medical University and Upstate's Joslin Diabetes Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me this morning. Well, first, Dr. Kelly, let's start with you. What is osteoporosis, but how does one get osteoporosis?
Well, osteoporosis is technically a thinning of the bone where it's not strong enough and it's at risk for fracture. So it can develop over time. It's possible that someone may have never reached their peak bone mass, say if they had troubles growing or irregular menstrual periods or were on medications such as steroids, didn't have enough calcium. Or it can occur over time, say especially when we think about postmenopausal women, once the estrogen is no longer available, that puts their bones at risk. And again, men too, they're at risk if they have low testosterone levels and different medications can put one at risk. So it can happen over time.
So you're really forming bone when you're young, right?
Right. The bone forms up until, and you reach your peak bone mass between about your 20s to 30s. So it's really important to try to get adequate calcium and vitamin D, regular exercise throughout those years, because you're really trying to fill up the stores to maintain and preserve later on in life.
I think that's a key point that not everyone really understands, that those are the years where you're really laying down the foundation for your bones.
Correct.
Yeah. So who's most at risk then, Karen?
Well, I think the person that we think of stereotypically is an older Caucasian or Asian female who's quite petite. But as Dr. Kelly mentioned, there's so many other factors that can create low bone mass and fragile bone that we have to kind of open our minds to who might have it, including people who have taken steroids for different conditions, men who have low testosterone, and so many other things that don't fit that stereotypical mold.
So is it possible that something that withdraws calcium, like breastfeeding, for example, can play a role in creating that?
Sure. Anything that takes away from laying down the bone that Dr. Kelly talked about certainly can put people at more risk.
What role does family history play?
There is a role. They're learning more all the time about different genetics involved with osteoporosis, but that actually is a major risk factor and something we always ask our patients, particularly if someone's had a mother with a hip fracture. It's very suggestive that they could be at risk.
So what exactly is the difference? Now, I mentioned in the introduction that a lot of people have just low bone mass. What's the difference between that and osteoporosis?
So the diagnosis osteopenia versus osteoporosis is based upon T-scores. So the way that osteoporosis is diagnosed is with a bone density machine. And it gives a number called T-scores. It's measured at the spine and hip. And a normal T-score is better than -1. If it falls between -1 and -2.5, that's considered osteopenia, and that's a wide range. And if it's -2.5 or less, that's considered osteoporosis. But now, if someone has a fracture that shouldn't have happened, you know, say they just fell from standing, you know, that's considered osteoporosis regardless of the T-score.
So bottom line is it's the severity.
Correct.
Basically, osteopenia, you're looking at it as a continuum, and basically osteoporosis is at the one end of the continuum, more severe, and osteopenia is the beginning. But does it mean that if you have, Karen, does it mean if you have osteopenia that you will always go on to develop osteoporosis?
Well, it is a precursor, so it depends on how your bones change throughout life. Unfortunately, as Dr. Kelly mentioned, from our peak bone mass by about age 30, we all slide downhill. So it depends on the rate that somebody does lose bone mass. So I guess the fortunate thing is if you live long enough, you are likely to progress on osteoporosis because that says that you've lived a good long life.
So what besides, obviously, clearly a fracture is the most obvious problem with osteoporosis, but what are some of the other sequelae? What are some of the other problems that you can encounter?
Well, with the fractures, particularly vertebral fractures, they can be very painful. I mean, any fracture can be painful. But especially if someone starts to lose height from spine fractures and start to lean over and develop a stoop posture, that can cause respiratory problems because they can't breathe as well. It can cause GI problems because the stomach's being compressed by the upper body. And especially after a hip fracture, it can be really devastating. It's very difficult for many people to return back to normal style of living. They may end up in a rehab facility or nursing home, and even the mortality is very high the first year after a hip fracture, even more so for men than women.
Yeah, I read that before, actually, in other contexts, that clearly issues of that fractures can wreak havoc on someone's life, as you mentioned. I mean, it can totally turn their life upside down, especially an older person, and they can end up with being bedridden and then with things like pneumonia.
Right, absolutely. So we want to prevent that before it happens.
Well, it seems to me that it's a major problem, but I guess in your experience, are you seeing more and more people experiencing it?
Well, I think, as Karen mentioned, the population's living longer, so and it is known that the older one is, there's more chance to have a fracture. So, and I think that now there's more awareness, so we're starting to screen more also, and that helps to identify the problem before someone develops a fracture.
Well, we have to take a short break, but we're going to be right back with more on osteoporosis and Dr. Kelly and Dr. Kemmes. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR. Back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with Drs. Jennifer Kelly and Karen Kemmes. And we're talking about that silent but very serious condition called osteoporosis. And we spent the earlier part of the session talking really about what is osteoporosis and how does it differ from osteopenia. But clearly, there are some very serious consequences to having osteoporosis. And just before the break, we talked about this issue of stooped posture and the so-called dowager hump. Are we seeing that around these days? I mean, are we still seeing it? And what causes that?
Well, unfortunately, we do still see patients that have this problem, because what happens if a person develops vertebral fractures in their spine and then the spine starts to hunch over, and that's where the stooped posture or the dowager hump occurs.
So tell me, Karen, this issue of it being a silent problem. I mean, people don't really know they have osteoporosis unless they've gone and had a bone density test. Is that correct?
Right.
So what are the consequences of it being silent? I mean, what are the possible problems?
You know, it's pretty easy to not worry about something until a negative thing happens. And back before we had bone density testing like we do now, people would just get fractures, and that was the first hint that they had osteoporosis. Now, fortunately, we do have the bone density testing, so that helps as long as people get one. But we still see a lot of people that maybe are not those stereotypical petite Caucasian female that do get fractures. About 2/3 of vertebral fractures are silent. People don't feel them when they happen, so they start to get these negative consequences
like
that you mentioned.
Like being bent over.
Hunched over, right, with all the difficulties with breathing and with digestion. And it really can throw off their balance, increasing their risk of a fall for subsequent fractures. So those things we need to be very attentive to, and hopefully people are getting testing done ahead of time to prevent those negative consequences.
I read somewhere that that it can be so bad that someone can literally just turn over in bed and fracture a hip. Is that true?
Yes, it's true. I mean, we've seen all different types of things like that occur. They'll just roll up in bed and fracture a rib, or just be walking and fall down. And a lot of people think that they fall and that's what caused the hip fracture, but many times the hips just fracture and then they fall.
Wow.
So it's really can be devastating.
Yeah, totally. Totally debilitating, make you basically housebound or bedridden or chair-ridden or something like that. So clearly we need to know about preventing it and treating it. So what do we need to know? What are the kinds of things we need to be doing? We'll start with you, Dr. Kelly, to prevent this.
Well, it's very important to try to take adequate amounts of calcium and vitamin D regularly, you know, throughout life, and that can be obtained from mixture of diet and supplements. Regular weight bearing exercise is important to keep the muscles and bones strong, good balance and posture, avoiding things such as smoking, excess alcohol, those are all helpful.
Well, things. Let's take each of them in kind of a little more detail. Let's start with calcium intake. I mean, in our diets, where do we get calcium generally? How can we, and are we talking about infants all the way up to, you know, adults?
Absolutely.
What are the recommendations?
Yeah, we want to start, you know, in those younger years, because those are the best years to lay down the strong bone and get in calcium and vitamin D. So calcium, probably the easiest source to get it is through dairy products, but so many people are lactose intolerant or just don't care for dairy products. So fortunately, we have so many other good options now. There's so many fortified foods that have these calcium and vitamin D, as well as the other nutrients that are so important. You can get orange juice that has calcium and vitamin D added.
And how about fish? I also think I've heard that fish can be...
Bony fish have calcium, so things like sardines and anchovies actually have calcium. Eel is known for having vitamin D, though our diets don't include much of that, so
right.
Vitamin D we end up getting in supplements oftentimes.
How about nuts? Do we think nuts carry it as well?
Nuts do have some of the nutrients we need, so it's important to look up. You know, there's a lot of online sources that have different foods, and then you can compare what you take in a normal day and how far you are from that, and then take supplements to make up for those important nutrients.
So what are the recommended supplements on an age-related basis? I mean, I read somewhere that starting from birth to 12 months, you want to have a certain amount of vitamin D and a certain amount of calcium, and then even into childhood, that's true. It's like 700 milligrams of calcium and like 600 milligrams of vitamin D between 1 and 3.
Right. So, you know, looking at those values, and again, there's great sources online to look at the specifics, but children and teenagers need around 700 to 1,000 milligrams of calcium and 400 to 600, it's international units, interestingly, of vitamin D. And then once we get into adulthood, it's pretty easy to think about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day, and the same thing for international units of vitamin D. But the important thing here is that that is inclusive of all your foods, beverages, and supplements. So you don't want to take that much in supplement. And it's a little confusing because calcium and vitamin D are a bit opposite, in that if you take too much calcium, you can get problems such as kidney stones. Vitamin D, it's pretty hard to take too much of that. So again, looking at how to take those things, watching how much you're getting in your food, beverage, and supplements, calcium, spread it out through the day because your body only absorbs about 500 to 600 milligrams at a time.
So, but there's been a lot of controversy. We've actually done a number of interviews on vitamin D of late. I mean, clearly it's a sunshine vitamin, and because we live in Cloud City or Cloudy City, right. We don't get very much in this part of the country. Mm-hmm. So what's the scoop, the real scoop on vitamin D? How much do we really need?
Well, it's true there's a lot of controversy in this area. As Karen mentioned, it really is difficult to take too much vitamin D, and we know that it really is so important just for bone health and many other medical diseases also. So as Karen mentioned, a rough safe number for most people is about anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 units of vitamin D daily. Many experts in the field suggest that people can take up to 4,000 units safely. And the one thing with vitamin D, it's very tough to obtain from food alone to receive adequate amounts, and that's why we find many people are vitamin D deficient when they come in and have their blood levels tested. And again, as you mentioned, it's tough to get from the sun because we don't have many sunshine months around here. So many people do need to take supplements for the vitamin D to have adequate amounts.
Right, and if you're not basically, like you said, it's not really available in food sources, although there are some food sources, much the same as in calcium. I guess some fish, as well as the fatty fishes like salmon, mackerel, tuna, that kind of thing.
Right. And one other problem with vitamin D is so many people don't absorb it well. So even if they take it in, they don't absorb it. But you can't tell oftentimes if that's the case. So the really helpful thing with vitamin D is a blood test can tell us what our levels are. So people really should speak to their physician to have this test done if they feel that they might be at risk. And a lot of people are. You can't tell by just looking at somebody.
So this is a recent advance in medicine to have the ability to actually assay the amount of vitamin D in our blood. And that was actually the result of, I mean, the content of some of the earlier interviews we did, that it was important to know your levels and then take the amount of vitamin D that will get you up to a safe level.
exactly. in your blood.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And we would see, when we still do have many consults over at the Joslin Center where someone would be referred over for osteoporosis worsening and the physicians didn't know why because the patient was taking their medication. And then we would find it was just as simple as testing their vitamin D level and it was not adequate and that needed to be replaced.
And that would make a big difference.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That's very interesting. Let's get on to the exercise. So they always talk about, you know, weight-bearing exercise as a way. Now, we're talking now both prevention and treatment, correct?
Absolutely.
So it builds our bones by bearing weight or stressing our bones. Yes. So what kinds of things are effective?
Well, when children can do a lot, and they really should build that bone bank. So kids should be out doing jumping jacks and jumping from monkey bars and whatever they can do to really get some pounding into the bones, and they can lay down great bones. Now, as the years go on, maybe we're not doing those sorts of activities, but we do want to keep walking, climbing stairs, dancing, hiking, really trying to get as much impact in the bones as possible. That stimulates the bones to get stronger.
And that's true even as you get older.
Absolutely. You know, continue doing those things as much as possible. The challenge is, as the years go on, we often have bone and joint pain that prevents some of those things. So then we have to weigh that out. So even though maybe riding a stationary bike isn't the greatest weight-bearing activity, perhaps if somebody has a knee problem that's painful, that's the best they can do. But they really want to try to put some impact into their bones to really help strengthen them. And also resistance training, so doing weight training programs. And that can be really helpful for those folks I just mentioned that have painful joints. They could really do a nice weight training program without placing the impact into the joints. So we have two really good options.
So that will help build bone as well, you're saying?
It absolutely
if
does.
If you use hand weights or you
yep,
nice, have ankle weights or that kind of thing.
Yep, weight machines, exercise bands, whatever people can use.
So how about the importance of not smoking? Is that really critical to preventing and also treating?
Yes, I mean, it's really been noted in many of the different evaluations over time about osteoporosis. And, you know, even when we see patients, especially of thinner body habits that have been smoking for a long time, those are ones that are usually red flags to screen for osteoporosis.
Dr. Kelly, what about medicines?
Well, the medications available to treat osteoporosis are very useful. In the big studies, they cut down fracture risks about 50 to 70%. With any medication, we worry about side effects. The mainstay of the treatment for osteoporosis is typically the bisphosphonate group, so those are the Fosamax, Actonel, Boniva. They're typically taken by mouth, and they have to be done a certain manner, first thing in the morning, full glass of water, not to lie down.
But do they work?
Oh, sure, they work very well in the big studies. And again, as I mentioned, they cut down fracture risk about 50 to 70%.
So they're helpful, but there's been some controversy, but I guess we don't need to really worry about those things.
Well, no, I mean, it's important to be aware of. There was some mentions in the news about atypical femur fractures, people's fractures happen spontaneously that have been on Fosamax for a long time. It's extremely rare, about 1 in 10,000, but it's something that we ask patients if they have thigh pain to let us know. And these fractures have been seen in people that never even taken bisphosphonate, so that's a bit reassuring also.
So the key point is check with your doctor.
Yes.
About your bone health. Well, Drs. Jennifer Kelly and Karen Kemis, both from the Upstate Joslin Diabetes Center, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us understand this very important problem. We have to take a short break, but there's more HealthLink on air ahead, so please stay with us. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.